It's the E-commerce Master Plan Podcast, here to help you grow your e-commerce business faster and more efficiently by cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and guidance from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello, Master Plan World. Welcome to our latest podcast. It is, as it always is, an absolute pleasure to have you listening. I'm Chloe Thomas, creator of the E-commerce Master Plan. I'm an author, speaker, and consultant, and I focus on e-commerce business strategy and marketing. So how to help all of you get more customers. We're now over halfway through our January series, the 2017 e-commerce growth series sponsored by Vico, the number one inventory software. And if you haven't heard the other episodes in this series, please do go back and check them out as we've had some great insights and ideas to help you succeed this year. Please also join in the discussion in our Masterplan World Facebook group that you can find via ecommercemasterplan.com/Facebook. Vico is the number one inventory software that allows you to sell across multiple marketplaces such as eBay, Amazon, Magento, WooCommerce, and Shopify. And you can try Vico for free today at info.vico.com/e-commerce-masterplan. Vico can make your systems work really smoothly, give your customers great service, and save you time. And that time saving is something we talked a lot about in the double episode of efficiency advice from Giorgio of Shop America. Well, today we're going to continue that theme, because today's special guest is Matt Warren, the founder of our series sponsors Vico. But don't worry, this isn't a pitch episode. No, no, no. Rather, we're going to be diving into what led Matt to create Vico in the first place. And it's a great story with lots of advice for all of you. Because before Vico, Matt was a serial e-commerce business owner, and it was his own experiences running those e-commerce businesses that led to the creation of Vico. First came Blitz Enterprises, a five-year project which Matt grew from nothing to over £6 million per year turnover. Next was Jura Watches, which was a seven-year project creating the UK's first official luxury watch retailer. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Chloe.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm okay. After that kind of epic intro there, I've only really scratched the surface of an overview of you and your businesses and what you've been up to. So can you let them know a little bit more of the colour around how you got started off in e-commerce, please?
Sure. So it was 14 years ago. I was a very young 22 years old. I was a software engineer in an IT company, and my boss offered me, or suggested, he could get me a discount on any watches. And being a bit of a geek, I decided, okay, what watches are they? How much do they cost? You know, what types are they? I didn't have a clue. So I did what I did. I went to Google, and I was surprised I couldn't find anyone selling watches or any information like, you know, types, brands, how much they cost. And in a light bulb moment, I thought, well, if no one's selling watches, I thought, well, this is a really good idea. I'm going to sell watches. I'm going to make millions of pounds doing this kind of thing. So, that's what kind of sparked it off, was that conversation from my boss. I just then developed my own website. I then decided to phone up all the watch brands, you know, Rolex, Omega, all these very sort of luxury brands, and said, hey guys, I've got this fantastic idea. I'm going to sell your watches online. I'm going to make us both loads of money. At which point they then completely laughed at me and told me how stupid an idea that was, that and the internet would never ever work, and that the internet's full of fakes and dodgy people. But me being a bit stubborn, I decided to crack on anyway, and I basically just, you know, put the products up there, even though I didn't have any stock. Quit my job, and then for like 4 weeks, nothing really happened. Didn't sell anything, and then suddenly we got our first sale. It was a Gucci watch for like £350 first sale. And then about 2 weeks later, we got another sale. It was actually really hard to find the watches because we didn't have any official suppliers. So I was literally phoning around trying to find them, get discounts so we could then pass them on to the customer.
So this was back in about 2002, right? So you got this, your boss went, do you want some watches? And you went, oh, interesting. Created the site. And then you put the product up there without anything in stock.
Yeah, basically, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So when that order came in, you were literally rushing around trying to find a watch to send to the customer?
Quite literally. I ended up finding someone to supply it to me and meeting him in Tesco car park to do the deal. I think we made about £30 profit on that first one, but it didn't matter, you know, and it was so much effort as well. It was just crazy. But it, for me, it proved that, hey, someone's willing to buy something quite expensive off my not that great website. So And the way we got traffic to it, because obviously it's brand new, was just some PPC ads. There was no competitors then, so it was very, very cheap.
Wow, so those first two sales in the first, 8 weeks, and then you thought, right, this is a goer. So what did you do next after that? Because obviously, you grew it over 5 years to seven figures, so...
I think at that point there was a bit of a dodgy moment where I got an offer for a really good lucrative job in London in IT, and there was after one sale, it was still always like, oh my God, my mortgage is coming out every month. How do I afford my bills? And I was racking up loads of debt just to sort of live and prove this. And then when the sales started to come in, I remember that it was probably Christmas time. We were getting two sales a week kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I was finding better suppliers around the world to do it. So it gradually built up. And then I decided to really kind of like go for it. I got myself a small office and just invested in some stock was probably the first thing we did. just so we could offer next day delivery and things like that.
So did you turn down that lucrative job in London then?
I did. I remember the contract was at home, and I was like really tempted, and all my friends and my family thought it was crazy. You should just take this brilliant job in London, it's a good career, that kind of stuff. I didn't for better or worse, but yeah, I didn't take the job. And then the business started to grow. And probably driven in the early days by PPC. And then obviously as things grew, SEO became really important. But to be honest, we didn't do anything special. There was no one selling watches online. There was no competitors. Can't say it was any sort of genius thing. It was just timing, really.
And you said once you took the, you went, right, we're going to take this seriously. I'm getting involved. The first thing you did was you bought stock so you could offer next day delivery, which is not necessarily the obvious option, certainly not back in kind of 2002. Kind of 2002, 2003 time, is because I read that as you went, right, customer service is going to be the winner here, which is very much a theme which we've only really seen emerging in the last couple of years as a big high ticket strategy for success and for growth. So, how come you went customer service first all the way back then?
I think customers, it's a very important selling point, stuff like next day delivery. Also confidence at the time when customers, were spending quite a lot of money online, especially for them. They wanted, if it was something, say, 10-day delivery or something against next day delivery, it's just more confidence for them. I thought for me, it's a big conversion point is, always has been delivery. How quick can you do it, basically? It helps people convert, doesn't it? If they know they're going to get it tomorrow, they're more likely to buy the item than waiting 10 days.
Yeah, and interestingly, there were some stats presented at Internet Retailing Conference by Feel Unique late 2016, I should say, who have done a big project about improving their delivery. And they've seen, listening to customer feedback and improving how they do the boxes and the courier methods and all the rest of it and the options they give customers in the first place, has increased overseas repeat orders by 50%, which, it just shows how important it is to get delivery right, both pre-purchase and post-purchase.
Absolutely, because it's a big differentiator between e-commerce customers, I think, and I see a bit of a competition now who can have the latest cutoff.
Yeah.
Because someone's at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon looking to have something, and you've got it offering still next day, and your competitor, said, well, that's going to be 2 days now, then they're not going to go with you. They're going to go with your competitor. So pushing those cutoffs as far as possible, as late in the day, is definitely an angle for retailers.
And quite an interesting logistical challenge as well.
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, the later the cutoff, the much harder
it is. it amazes me how the geography plays. Well, it kind of, when you think about it, it's kind of obvious that delivery, that geography would play into how late you can cut it off, because it's all about what time the couriers need it into their main depot. So the closer you are to the main depot, the more it is. But to think that that's something which is defining people's kind of investment strategies when it comes to bricks and mortar is quite impressive on the larger scale. But I feel we're diving down a very interesting cul-de-sac, but away from your story. So Matt, once you'd improved that customer service, how did you then grow your site selling watches to the 6 million it got to by 2007?
So the big focus was product catalog, because there was limited information about the different products. We added thousands and thousands of different products. And to be honest, most of them we didn't expect to sell because they're quite unusual or rare. But it built up a really good website of product information. So if you're remotely interested in watches or looking for watches, it became a really good place just to have a good browse around. And that then also was, had really benefits for SEO because we had thousands and thousands of product pages. So good for SEO, good long keywords. And that then started driving natural SEO. It probably took 8 months before the SEO really started becoming a major source of traffic for us. Because initially we were just driving it purely through relatively cheap PPC. But, you know, even by the first year, we were spending probably over, I don't know, £15,000 a month on PPC. And the SEO was just our pure focus on the product catalogue, you know, making sure we had really good images on there, really good descriptions, stuff like, you know, how big is the case, how big is the strap, that kind of stuff is, you know, very useful for lots of people, even people not buying, but, you know, just doing research. So that initially that was the first few years was that. And then it was a case of we didn't do any PR, we didn't do any we did the AdWords in-house, which is fine then. I don't think that I would recommend that nowadays. Yeah. And it was just, those were the kind of things that were growth. And yeah, I think in the first year we did £1 million in the end. It kind of grew quite rapidly.
And so your strategy was really just to focus on enabling people to be able to find you via the PPC and the SEO side of things.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and that those were really the routes to market back in 2002.
And that continued as the strategy through to 2007 in terms of growth?
I think it changed. We suddenly got lots of competitors. People found out we're being successful. So they just sprung out of nowhere, like literally five of them. And so we had to get better at stuff like SEO. We started then doing a bit more content a little bit, but quite limited. But yeah, to be honest, it was purely focused on PPC, SEO were the two main drivers that brought us most of our traffic. And I think probably referrals in the last few years of that business definitely helped, you know, because it became known as a good, cheap place that was offering sort of next day delivery on watches.
Cool. Well, I want to jump on to Jura Watches now, which you set up in 2007. And that was rather a different start, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it's probably worth mentioning that what happened with Blitz wasn't a very, very great ending, to be honest. Commercially, a very successful company, you know, 7-figure turnover, 6-figure profit, commercially fantastically well. What happened is we became so successful, the watch brands were not happy at all about us because we weren't official retailers. We were just buying them from there. You know, where they sold it to a shop, we'd go to that shop and buy them off them. Mm-hmm. So we kind of breaking, you know, they were really happy about this. We were buying from other countries, so people like, for example, Gucci UK, very upset that we were buying from perhaps Gucci France. So we then had a lot of litigation from these big brands trying to sort of close us down. And they just tied us up in sort of loops of litigation, costing us in the end, I think, £500,000.
Wow.
We had to close down the business. Just we could not afford to, you know, to handle that, manage that kind of thing. It was unfortunate. But that was a really tricky time for me, you know, to have been so successful. Mm. Personally, done really well, had, you know, big house, nice cars, and then lost, basically, we had to close down the business. I had to sell everything, house, cars, it was a bit of a low point for me.
I can imagine.
You know, you lose a bit of face. You know, no one cares whether it's commercially it closed down or whether you got sued a bit. Just, you know, it's still the same thing. You lost your business, closed down kind of thing. So at the same time, rather stupidly, I decided that, okay, if we're going to, you know, we know what to do. We know how to sell watches, and we think there's a better market in the luxury watches, actually. And so this time we're going to start a new business, but we're going to go into partnership with the luxury brands.
See, I find that amazing that you could go through the pain of being sued by them to the extent that it cost you your business and everything else, but at the same time you see an opportunity of actually working with them. I mean, that's quite an emotional, that's a very grown-up thing to do, I think. I think many of us would go, well, screw you, I'm going to go and do something else. But to actually then try and very successfully get in bed with them is quite, I'm in awe, and I imagine a lot of our listeners are going, wow, I'd have run to the hills.
I think there was a bit of stubbornness, but also a bit of we got hooked in. So what happened is before this litigation kicked off, we kind of saw this coming, as in we had hints of it coming, and we decided on doing this other model anyway of working with them, you know, and doing it properly kind of thing, and working with the luxury brand. So we'd really sort of committed quite a lot of money to starting this kind of new brand, a new company, to the point that we had quite a lot of money put into it and everything. And yeah, so that company ended, and we had a choice. Right, we commit this money. Do we go ahead with it? It must have been just stupidity, to be honest. I said yes. I mean, let's go for it. We raised money from angel investors, and we raised money from the bank, because working with luxury brands meant we had to have a bricks and mortar store. No way would they supply online only. It just was never happening back then. So, and we had to, it couldn't be just any store. It had to be something really impressive, because they can pick and choose who they go with, the luxury watch brands, and distribution is very limited. So we opened a store in Mayfair. Well, we took a rent out on a very expensive rent in Mayfair. But obviously the watch brands wouldn't supply us until they'd seen the store and were happy and decided. So we took out this massive 5-year lease in this really expensive store. We paid, I think, $250,000 to shop fit it. And it was a very scary and horrible time, because all this money we'd raised was literally going out the door faster than we'd raised it. We had no suppliers on board. None of the watch brands have committed. It was a sucky time, to be honest. It was really difficult because it was really stressful. But eventually we got the store open. It looked amazing. We went for like a digital store. We had the world's biggest plasma screen, 106 inches across the back, lots of touch screens everywhere. So we're trying to mix the digital with the sort of traditional watch stuff. We opened it, and we persuaded about, I think, three brands, very small, minor brands, to come on board initially to sort of get us going. So I think then we launched the store. 2 months later, we ran out of money, and it was pretty horrific. And then we went back to our investors, and that meeting I remember very well. I thought it was going to be pretty terrible. I pretty much thought we were going to get a complete torn apart. But bizarrely, they were really supportive, because although we just launched the business, the online stuff had gone really, really well, even with these minor brands, enough that they were very encouraged. That we managed to persuade. It was the first time any luxury brands allowed anyone to sell online. So they backed us, they put more money in, and then I think 7 months later, we got it back to break even. We were lucky to have good investors and managed to get through that, but it was pretty close to a failed one business and start the next one and nearly fail straight away would have been horrific.
So just to clarify there, those three initial minor watch brands that you got convinced by the store to let you stock their product and sell it online, they actually kind of financed you to the point, because they could see the success. So your suppliers actually ended up helping you survive.
They did, yeah. So one of the watch brands is a watch brand called Oris. It's not like, you know, a Rolex or Cartier, but it is a decent, good, really good brand. And they allowed us to sell online and we stocked in store. And the online sales were phenomenal, because no one else was selling this brand online. And they were like, wow, this is really cool. They're very skeptical and very worried about selling online. And it was hard work to persuade them, really hard work. But they were really impressed, and they give us decent credit terms for stock, which they really didn't have to and probably shouldn't have if they had known our financial situation. But that, and then our investors put another, I think, £100,000 in, gave us enough then to, you know, get back, you know, get things in order and get the everything going. And then it was just a case of then spending 3 years persuading other brands to come on board, which was very difficult, because a lot of those obviously had sued us and didn't particularly like us. That was very challenging. And I am very proud of the team and me for doing that. For one, the company that sued us turning around, and secondly, persuading them to sell online when they were skeptical. So we're very skeptical.
So did you in the end get everybody you wanted? I don't need you to name names. I'm just curious.
I think we got about 90% of them, yeah. So yeah, most of them, a few didn't, but they haven't sold online with anyone. So it's a case of we persuaded everyone else. And I think we were the first company in the world to be allowed to sell online, kind of thing. So yeah.
Excellent. So that was quite the roller coaster as well. So what was did you go back to kind of the search strategy to grow that business as well? Was that pay-per-click and SEO based?
Yeah, so obviously brand new company, brand new website, SEO starts from zero. So initially it was PPC driven. In fact, it was PPC driven. The SEO obviously didn't kick off. Initially, we were so desperate for sales, we did everything. We went to watch forums. We started working, you know, going to watch forums, answering questions to people, not giving everyone the hard sell, just trying to be generally useful. And particularly on the niche watch forums for that brand, just being helpful to people. And that actually helped a lot initially. It's not a scalable business model, to be you know, commenting on forum posts, but it got us enough sales to, again, help. So we were just scrabbling around all different areas like that to try and grab any sale we could, basically.
And then that continued to grow through to 2014. So what did it continue being the pay-per-click and SEO side of things, or did it become more about the customer service and the delivery? What do you think was the reason you might be able to grow it so high? And did you keep the store as well?
Yeah, so the store was a massive driver for the online stuff as well. So the store in its own right became profitable, but that was also a massive driver. It was in a busy location, so it got a lot of footfall. It really helped us build a brand. And I think that's one thing a lot of retailers don't think about, is about building your own brand. When we first started Jura, I wanted to just call it something like Swiss Watches, because we're selling Swiss watches. Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And we hired this brilliant guy called Alistair to be our marketing director, and he kind of taught me that if you call it Swiss Watches, no one's going to remember your name. They're going to think it's like, you know, smart watches, Swiss watches. They'll just forget it because they're just two generic names. And he invested a bit of time in coming up with the word Jura. And the reason it's called Jura is because it's an area of Switzerland called the Jura Mountains, where all the watch manufacturers effectively are there. And it became, the word Jura means nothing to most people, and therefore the brand became important. People, you know, recognized us. And it, down the line, that became a big driver for our growth, actually having our own brand, which people knew what it represented. Jura meant we were the online retailer of luxury watches that, you know, had where customer service was really important for us. So we even had a concierge service we gave to customers when they bought from us. And we partnered with the concierge company, so they'd get like a membership and they could fill out this concierge service, and they, you know, help them from anything from their plumbing to buying their next supercar or stuff like that. So I think brand helped us, not in the first year, or maybe the second year, but third, fourth, that started adding value. We did things like we did our own magazine. Again, there's something I wouldn't have done, but our marketing director created this beautiful luxury magazine about watches. That was really interesting to read if you're interested in magazines. Very cleverly, he got the brands to pay for it by them taking adverts in it. We paid really good journalists then to write interesting content. We sent it around to all our customers. We had a big database by then. So there's lots of things that perhaps, you know, I learned was, you know, yes, I know a lot about tech and I know a lot about SEO and the digital side of stuff. But there's a lot of stuff I didn't know that Alistair helped and added a really good element to us.
Especially in the luxury sector, to be doing those more tangible, more attractive to that customer base types of marketing that don't really feel like marketing to them. They're just as high value as the watches are, can be really powerful.
They take a lot of investment in time, planning, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, and quite risky for that reason. But the payout for them were pretty big for us in the end. I think the other thing is working with suppliers. We asked to build a really good relationship with all the watch brands, attending events with them, doing events on their behalf even. So we had lots of events in our store for the watch brands where we'd invite VIP customers down. It was a lot of work. There wasn't much sales in it for us, but the watch brands really loved that we were promoting their brand. And that meant then they helped us further down the line with everything from payment terms to more co-marketing with them. So I think co-marketing and stuff like that with suppliers, maybe, you know, for some categories it doesn't work. But I think for a lot of categories, you'd be surprised, you know, approaching a supplier about marketing, you know, sharing the cost of doing a marketing campaign is entirely possible.
It is amazing quite how many product suppliers who you wouldn't have thought have an amount of budget available to spend on other people's marketing. If you just turn around and ask, you know, we're planning on doing this postcard and we'd like to feature your product on it. It's £200 per thousand to support it. You know, all of a sudden, you know, you've at least got your print costs covered, if not pushing towards some of your postage too.
Exactly. So a good example is GQ magazine, obviously a very well-known magazine. The back page advert there is about £15,000. But the watch brands like it because it's really good brand identity for them. So they were happy to sort of, you know, co-pay for an advert where we focus their brand on our store kind of thing. So and it worked really well for both parties.
Excellent. So what happened at the end of Jura then?
So after selling watches for 12 years and by the end of it not liking watches all that much, I kind of fell out of love with them. My background is tech and technology. So a time was right for me to move on, and I wanted to get into a technology business. You know, the tech world is very hot right now. So I decided to, we sold the business basically, and one of the biggest independent retailers in the UK, a company called CW Sellers, headquartered in the Peak District, but they've got like, I think, 17 stores around the UK. I'd known them for a long time, and we sold the business to them.
And was that, I guess I don't want to get massively into how to sell a business, but just to give those people out there who think that might be their exit strategy at some point, how long did it take you to sell it? Was it like, oh, we want to sell it and tomorrow the deal goes through, which I'm pretty confident is not the answer. How long did it take you to get from the germination of the idea through to the cash in the bank?
So skipping out the marketing, the company, we didn't do any of that. We just went because I had a relationship, I went to them directly and said, do you want to buy it? And what went to the point was where they said they were interested. From that point, it took 9 months to sell the business. I'm not going to lie, it's pretty painful for both parties. Obviously, it's a lot of money. It's a big purchase. I think from the buyer's point of view, they're always worried about skeletons in the cupboard. You know, things are going to come back and bite them, and it's a very scary thing buying a company. You know, how well is it really run? You can drill into numbers, you can drill into paperwork, that kind of stuff. So it did take a long time. It is quite stressful, but it's just like buying a house, probably just 10 times worse.
and given the fact you just had one buyer in mind and you went straight to them and said, are you interested? You did it the fast track way, I would suggest.
Yeah, so actually with my previous business, Blitz, about a year before we went into legal trouble, we actually decided to sell that business as well. And with that one, we actually just put it for sale. We use a third-party agent, which I would highly recommend. So people who are specialists in selling businesses, and they marketed it for us. They shielded the calls, filtered out the people. I think in the end, we had then four people left that were interested. And we got quite far down the line with that. But that was really fun and exciting, to be honest. You know, all these people come in, were really interested in, you know, loved what we built, were really interested in buying it from all sorts of people. That didn't work out in the end. But that buying bit there is really exciting. I'd say the bit afterwards where you agreed a deal and you've got to then try and everyone's trying to hold on and make sure the deal goes through and trying to herd lawyers to do what you wanted to do. My really big advice for selling is when you agree a deal with someone, get the heads of terms very detailed, like 2-3 pages. So what you don't want is the lawyers negotiating minor points 6 months down the lines for you, because they love to do that and charge you for it.
And just for anyone out there who's wondering what a heads of terms is, essentially at the point where you agree to do the deal, you create a document of all the key points of the deal, and you and both the buyer and the seller sign it, and then you get the lawyers fully involved to dot the I's and cross the T's. And so if you've left kind of things a bit woolly in that heads of terms, they will have a field day negotiating stuff that neither you nor the seller care about. Tricky.
Absolutely. Definitely. And any small detail left out, then you've got to renegotiate 6 months down the line. And at that point, things can be quite, you know, no one wants to give an inch. Everyone's pretty felt like it was an okay deal. We're all both happy with it. But then if something comes up, it's very, very difficult.
So let's flip on to you said post your world of watches, it was time to move into the tech world. And was that your creation of Vico?
Yeah, so I spent 12 years in e-commerce, you know, running a, we ended up with Duracell 2 stores. We bought another company and another store. So we had, you know, 2 stores. We were selling on Amazon. We were selling through, originally my website, we moved to Shopify. There was a lot of phone orders. We did trade events and stuff as well. And it was just frustration of, you know, when you're running a business, you just want to sell stuff. I wanted to sell watches. I wanted to provide a good service to my customers. But you end up with so much time taken up by stuff like, you know, making sure your inventory is right. You know, is your inventory right? Is there stock missing? Getting the order shipped out on time. That all that kind of stuff gets in the way a lot of the time. And I try to find like different platforms to do it, and there's quite a few out there. I could never find one that was easy to use, was web-based, and did all the things I want, which was, you know, inventory, shipping and listing all in one platform.
And by listing, you're meaning putting the products on Amazon, eBay, etc., and other marketplaces?
Yeah.
Just to clarify that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one thing I definitely strongly recommend is diversifying. So if you're just selling on Amazon, you know, you are beholden to Amazon. If you're just selling on your website, that's good. You've got your own brand and everything, but you're probably losing or leaving money on the table in terms of other channels that you could be making money on. And also your business becomes stronger if you diversify. And if you're selling on multiple channels, you know, if SEO drops off one day, you're not dead. You still got your Amazon or your eBay or, you know, your Etsy sales coming in. So, yeah.
I have to say, on that note, and I try and avoid politics as much as possible on this podcast and generally in life. But I have to say, I think one of the big themes of 2017, given that we've got the Trump confusion and the Brexit confusion and lots of interesting crazy going on in the world of international trading and currency exchanges and all the rest of it, I think there's going to be a big move in e-commerce to take advantage of the fact of how easy it can be to sell cross-channel, cross-border and cross-marketplace. And I think even the company with the strongest personal website is going to get to the point where they want to diversify that risk.
Yeah, exactly. It's diversifying risk. It's not like putting all your eggs in one basket. Mm. And I totally agree about international. eBay and Amazon in the last 6 months have launched tools to make it so much easier to list on foreign versions of their websites, you know, doing good, really good translations, do proper currency conversion. You've got, you know, GSP from eBay so that you can ship goods to the UK and they'll forward it on to an international. So it's getting easier and easier to do it. And I think, you know, as I think more retailers will hopefully, like you say, will look to international, especially British ones, you know, because there's a real opportunity there.
So all that e-commerce learning led you to create Vico. So what do you think? And actually, we should also say Vico, of course, is an e-commerce business itself. It's one of the SaaS ones, the software as a service, which we've had a couple of guests on talking about those in the past. So just quickly before we get into the top tips, Matt, what do you think is the most awesome thing about Vico right now?
That's the awesome thing about Vico. It's cheesy, but I love dealing with lots of e-commerce companies. So I meet new ones every day. We've got some amazing ones there and learning all the new stuff that e-commerce companies are doing. Like Instagram's massive now for a lot of them in terms of as a sales channel. But as a company, the big thing at the moment is we're expanding really fast. We're just about to raise about £4 million, which we're going to use to open an office in the US, if Mr. Trump allows us to. and we're just really focused on building, making the product much better. So making it even easier, more integrations, more channels, more shipping integrations, and really building out the features.
This e-commerce growth series is sponsored by Vico. Vico is the number one inventory software. Vico allows you to sell across multiple marketplaces, such as eBay, Amazon, Magento, WooCommerce, and Shopify. You can try Vico for free today at info.vico.com/e-commerce-masterplan. Vico is V-E-E-Q-O, so that's info.vico.com/e-commerce-masterplan. Okay, cool. Well, I think then we should move on into the top tips round. And I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. So Matt, first up, your book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
I would recommend the biography on Elon Musk. And the reason being is that you get lots of books. You get practical books and inspirational books, in my eye. And I enjoy both, but I get more value out of inspirational books because practical stuff, you can read blogs, you can listen to podcasts. There's a way to learn things. But to be really inspired, you know, to really get you motivated again sometimes, especially if you've had a bad few months, you can read a book by Elon Musk where he basically his vision is to go to Mars, to build a spaceship to go to Mars and to rid the world of fossil fuels. There's no bigger vision from one man. And the fantastic thing is he's achieving that vision, which is, you know, just crazy, really. And that book really inspired me and motivated me.
Excellent. The traffic top tip next, then. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
Well, from feedback from a lot of our customers here at Vico, I would definitely investigate Instagram because we have customers now who are doing seven-figure turnovers based purely on Instagram marketing, which is phenomenal. Even for things that perhaps aren't that exciting, one of them is a fitness company that sell fitness exercise things. But they've taken a bit of a lifestyle approach to it, and they have, I think, 100,000 followers, and most of their sales come from that. I think one of your previous podcasts was around that, and it definitely is a trend I've seen, is stuff like Instagram and the other sort of image social networks is something I would investigate if I was a retailer.
Yeah, if you're in the right product, you can swing it in the right way. It's crazily effective, and maybe we need to have a chat later, Matt, about getting one of your Instagram success stories on the podcast later this year, I think.
Definitely.
Okay, the tool top tip then. Maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
I would say Slack is our tool. Probably one that's probably been mentioned before, but it is fantastically useful. We have quite a remote team here. We have two offices in the UK, and we have loads of guys remotely working around the world. And Slack is just a place for us to all want to chat together. And also we can share files, images, and we have different channels in there. So we can have a channel about a marketing channel, we can have a sales channel, we can have a support channel, and then it's a great place for the whole company to talk to each other in real time and try and keep the company culture together.
So it's both kind of task orientated and culture chat orientated.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. The startup top tip. If you met someone this weekend who's thinking of starting an e-commerce business or even a SaaS business, what would be your first piece of advice for them?
My first bit would be research in terms of competitors and making sure that your USP against those competitors is really 10 times better than your competitors. Because once you're 6 months, 12 months into a business, you invest in money and you realize that what you're doing is only slightly better, it's hard to be competitive. So if you're a retailer, if you're starting out, go niche, go super niche to start with. It doesn't matter if the total market's tiny, at least you get, it's a great way to kick off and you're more likely to get noticed for that reason. The other bit of advice I would give is when I started Jura, I built a really strong management team. I was still quite young, I was about 25 when I started that. And I surrounded myself with really good people who've been there and done it in different places, a really strong marketing guy. It's amazing if you go and ask people in your local business community who are well respected and very clever that you want them to become your mentor or you want them to be your advisor and perhaps give them a bit of equity in your business, or maybe they'll even do it for free. Even reach out to well-known people in the world of e-commerce and say, look, will you sit on my board for twice a year to give me advice? It's amazing what people will do in those circumstances and how often they'll say yes. And those people can really help you fill in the gaps that you have in terms of your own skill set as a CEO. Or the rest of the business.
Some excellent advice there. Well, Masterplan World, you can find those top tips and links to everything else we've been chatting about in today's episode by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com/85-5. Matt, before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can find you and your business on the web and social media, please?
So you can find more about Veeco at www.veeco, which is veeqo.com.
As easy as that. Well, I'll add that link as well and everything else we talked about in the show notes. Masterplan World, those are at ecommercemasterplan.com/85-5, or just head to the website, click on the podcast tab or use the search box. Matt, thank you so much for being on the E-commerce Masterplan podcast today and for being so incredibly generous, sharing the experience of your ups and downs of your e-commerce life with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Claire. It's been an absolute pleasure for me. I'm going to keep listening to all your podcasts. They are fantastic.
Thank you very much. Wow, what a roller coaster is Matt's journey there. And a fantastic story. I know that's a bit different from what we usually do, but I hope you've all got some good takeaways there, some reassurance, some ideas maybe about how that might fit in with your journey in the world of e-commerce, because there's, that's my head still spinning from that interview. That was great. Well, look, if you've enjoyed the start of our 2017 e-commerce growth series sponsored by Veeco, then please make sure you're spreading the word to your e-commerce friends, because I want to get this great content out to as many people as possible. Spread it however you like. If you can't think of someone to tell, or you can't think of a social media platform to put it on, then please do head over to iTunes and put a review on for me, because that will help put it in front of new people. It's how their algorithm works. And of course, make sure you join in the conversation in the E-commerce Masterplan World Facebook group, which you can find via ecommercemasterplan.com/Facebook. Next time, which is just a couple of days away, we're going to be diving into the world of bricks and clicks. So all of you bricks and clicks businesses out there have been wondering when I was going to include that this month. Well, that's coming up very, very soon. And we're going to be talking about that with the highly successful business Love Aroma. It's a great story and there's loads of great tips and advice in that one for you too. So have a great week, all of you, and keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com.